Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, August 22nd, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And please note that our shows will also be archived on drsaputo.com.
You're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips today at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include, do herbal supplements affect chemotherapy?
And are dogs going to be the future in detecting cancer?
That's a good one. And how can you reduce the effects of a high-fat meal naturally?
And child abuse can lead to long-term depression with little response to traditional medicines and psychotherapy. And much, much more. Plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. So, do herbal supplements affect chemotherapy? You know, herbal supplements may adversely affect chemotherapy treatment, and doctors are urging patients to discuss supplements with their oncologist before beginning treatment. But what do mainstream doctors know about herbs?
I mean, there's a little detail.
We're talking things like acai berries and cumin and herbal teas and turmeric and garlic. But what about taking drugs with chemo? Why single out herbs and supplements?
You have such a good point. You know, we tend to maximize what we know and make it all about that and minimize what we don't know. So we throw out the baby with the bathwater when it comes to using herbs and supplements and different things that are not mainstream for treating cancer. But in actactuality, if you don't have much of a depth of knowledge about it, what you've got is an opinion that's based on what? Nothing.
Well, you know, mainstream doctors want patients to bring their supplements with them to their doctor visits.
Mm-hmm.
But what do mainstream doctors really know about supplements and vitamins?
Well, they've heard a little. And sometimes there's a case report that comes out of someplace that's remote or not. And then all of a sudden it's in the news and they're making a big deal out of it. You know how many deaths there were last year from vitamins, Vicky? Try zero. And there are probably not more than about 50 deaths a year from herbs and other supplements all combined together.
And how many from medications?
Now you got a few decimal points different. You're looking at 400,000 deaths and millions of hospitalizations. So we're spending all our time picking on the poor herbs, okay, and some of the natural approaches that we use to treat chemotherapy, when it damn well is a responsibility of the oncologist to know this stuff. It's outrageous to me that they don't take the time to learn this, because it's an integral part of the treatment of a human being who has a serious illness.
And what about medications with chemotherapy?
Another point. Because we're in the business in medicine of using pharmaceutical drugs, we tend to put them on an altar, and they're almost sacred. But the amount of research we do on it, not good. And the research that does come out, very opinionated, with conflicts of interest all over the place.
Well, you know, I think that this all seems kind of like a theory because, you know, chemotherapy is toxic. And the idea is that it's supposed to kill the cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
But along with it, it kills the healthy cells. So I think, this is what I think, that the doctors are afraid if you take supplements with the chemotherapy that it might make the cancer cells healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what if that were true? What would be wrong with taking your chemotherapy, say, in the morning and your supplements at night,
exactly,
or vice versa? I mean, that's not at the same
time.
Well,
the first thing, Vicky, see, you're making a great point here, but the first thing that needs to be done is doctors need to be trained in areas where they have opinions that they worry about. And it's not like I'm standing out here saying, oh, herbs don't matter, just take any old herb you want if you've got cancer, and don't worry about the chemotherapy, it won't interact. I am not saying that. I'm just saying, do your homework, be responsible. look at all the different aspects of what can be used to treat your patient with cancer, and don't just limit it to things that are toxic that very often don't work and very often have data that's been put into the mainstream literature that is inaccurate. There's studies like that all over the place.
Well, when you think about it, they're afraid of are taking herbs, but herbs are plants, and we eat plants.
Well,
so
yeah, but
are we supposed to stop eating?
Well, you know, you could make that point, and it's a good one, but you can also take the point that hemlock is natural, and you don't want to be eating that plant. So, I mean, you're making a point. We should do our homework. We should do the research. We should understand what's there. And it's the NIH that should be doing this research, and it's not taking on its responsibility. It's kowtowing to Big Pharma. There is such an incestuous relationship between government agencies and a Congress in this country
and
the FDA that it's crazy. And that should just be not just outrageous. It should be something we just don't tolerate.
Well, you know, there are alternative therapies for cancer, and sometimes they've been effective. And some of these, many times people have to go out of the country to get them.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them are centered around good nutrition. And, you know, we know that cancer cells really like sugar, and mm-hmm. sugar's not good for us anyway. So if a person has cancer, one of the things, it's common sense, is to avoid sugar at all costs.
Why would you give up something that has high fructose corn syrup as a supplement that's supposed to give them calories? It's like insanity. Be smart about how you do it.
Well, the other thing to avoid if a person has cancer is iron.
Exactly.
We know that the cancer cells really store iron and really like iron.
It makes them grow better. They sequester it.
Yeah, and that's where the artemisinin comes in. We did another show a few weeks ago about artemisinin. It's an herb.
It's called wormwood extract.
And it goes after the iron that's stored in the cancer cells.
Yeah.
And then we also talked about methyl jasminate on another show a few weeks ago, and about how that goes after the mitochondria of the cancer cells and can kill the cancer cells. So what's wrong with oncologists learning a little bit more outside of the box and expanding their knowledge about things? Because, you know, their patients are coming to them asking them a lot of these
things. Let's say it another way, Vicki. It's irresponsible on the part of an oncologist to not know what the integrative alternative therapies are, because this is somebody's life. And a lot of people are dying from cancer. We've got 500,000 people dying every year from cancer.
Well, more and more all the time, because our environment is so polluted.
Well, that's part of it. But the point I'm making here is that they have a responsibility to learn whatever they can. And our medical schools have let us down. And our National Institutes of Health has let us down because they're not doing the research that should be done here. They should be spending billions of dollars on cancer research that's complementary and alternative. The things like artemisinin and methyl jasminate is absolutely at the top of the list. I mean, these are things that you can't patent, so nobody's going to want to do the research on, that absolutely needs to be done, that's not being done.
And then what if there's a type of cancer, like, say, for example, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, that we know responds pretty well to chemotherapy?
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with using the insulin along with that? Because there's something called insulin potentiated therapy.
Exactly.
And if you use that with the chemo, you don't have to give as much chemotherapy.
Exactly. At least the research should be done. But to have this attitude, this arrogant attitude, this naive arrogance, that just because it's not been studied, there are no clinical trials, doesn't mean that something doesn't work. And if it's been around for thousands of years, for God's sakes, maybe there's just something to it that's worth an investigation. But I think that Big Pharma has such a lock on Congress, and Congress such a lock on the FDA and CDC, etc., that the corruption there prevents this research from occurring. Think of the amount of money that it would cost Big Pharma if all of a sudden we had some therapies that would supplant the use of toxic chemotherapy that may cost you $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 a year if you had to buy it, and it doesn't do that much good. I mean, this is all over the place.
And just about all that Western doctors kind of go along with as far as complementary alternative medicine for people that have cancer is acupuncture, massage.
I think the mainstream is starting to look at that a little bit.
And meditation.
I know,
it helps the stress and the pain, and it helps the patients to cope.
Well, look at Donald Abrams at San Francisco General Hospital, in the city here. He's the chief of oncology and hematology there. And he wrote a book called Integrative Oncology.
We're in New York here.
Oh, in San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Who wrote a book called Integrative Oncology with Andrew Weil that talks about the things that you can add to what we do in the mainstream that make the comfort okay, that you have when you're going through chemotherapy or just cancer itself, something that you could tolerate a little better. And after all, isn't life an awful lot about trying to be comfortable and to enjoy yourself and to be able to have quality of life that means something? Isn't that a lot of what it's about? All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health or you want to join in our conversation, give us a call. Again, it's 874-4888.
So here's a cancer detection method that you may not have thought of. Sniffer dog. You know, they found that there are dogs that are trained to detect the scent of early lung cancer.
Isn't that amazing?
And they can even distinguish it from COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, tobacco smoke, and even food odors. I mean, I think that this is pretty amazing that dogs have such a keen sense of smell.
Well, I mean, most animals do. Their primary sense is olfactory. You look at the case of a bear. If you're 5 miles away from a bear, and you're downstream or upstream from the bear, I mean, that bear is going to sniff you out, know where you are, and know what you've got. If you've got food and he wants it, he's going to find you. And the same thing is with dogs. It's remarkable. My friend Michael Brothman, who's an acupuncturist at OMD here in San Anselmo, California, is an expert in this area. He has some dogs that can do that for breast cancer and sniffed them. And he's published some work in medical journals, just like this stuff that's talked about for lung cancer is published in medical journals. There's something to it.
This is wonderful because lung cancer, you know, is the most common cause of death mm-hmm. from cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to detect until it's pretty far along.
Even if you find it pretty early, it's tough, and the chemotherapy simply doesn't do much. I mean, if you help 5% of people to live 5 years, you've done a big deal here. So if you can find it really early and know that you're right, that would make a big difference.
So how does this work? I know there's chemicals that are created by cancer that can get in the blood, and that there's something that is used in Western medicine called a spectrophotometer. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, see, a spectrophotometer really just analyzes whatever's present in a liquid or a gas form, and it can tell you all the chemicals that are there, and it does the same thing basically that the dog's nose does. It'll say, oh, this chemical's here, and it'll tell you even how much is there. So spectrophotometry is something I think that is on the cutting edge of where we're going in the diagnosis of cancer. I don't think there's any doubt that this is going to be a mainstream approach that we use to detect it earlier. That's so much more safe.
You know what I think would be so great is that if a doctor had a sniffer dog in his office mm-hmm. and didn't need to tell people that even that that's what the dog did. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of people like dogs, and many times they bring comfort to people. If people don't like the dog, then they can fill out a form that says they don't like it, and they can put the dog in the other room. But if the dog could sniff it, it would help the doctor with his or her diagnosis.
Well, here's the problem. Would the dog find cancers that would go away spontaneously? We don't know that. We know that about 20%, maybe 25% of breast cancers disappear. And we have plenty of studies that go, doesn't make sense except to explain that there were spontaneous remissions and they're very common. So would you want to do something like, say, that would be equivalent to a CT scan of the chest, which a lot of people have suggested for lung cancers? And the question is, okay, so you're using your CT scanner now and you're finding all kinds of cancers, but are these cancers that are going to do anything? And you don't know the answer. So while I like the idea of exploring this further, it's probably a little premature to bring dogs in everybody's office.
Well, maybe those
even
are the
though they're great pets.
Well, maybe those are the types of patients that doctors might agree to use some complementary alternative medicine that has no harm to the patient.
You've got a good point
there. You know, like the artemisinin.
I think when you're stuck and you don't have the data, you have to improvise. And a lot of it's, well, almost always, we don't have the data to justify what we're doing, but I don't think it always takes data, even though I'll be the first one to admit that until we have good solid data, we can't be sure, because sometimes we do things for, you know, 100 years, like we did with the Halstead radical mastectomy for breast cancer. We figured taking more out was better. And of course, the logic of it makes sense, but the problem is it didn't do any good. We found out just a simple lumpectomy did the same thing as taking off the breast, the muscles underneath it, the connective tissue, and sometimes even ribs, taking out the axilla and all those nodules, and sometimes even the whole arm. That's how radical it got, and it did one sliver of difference of doing just a plain old lumpectomy. So you have to be careful with your intuition. But if you're doing radical things like Halstead did and you're ripping people apart, that's one thing. But if you're doing not radical things that don't have side effects that might be of some value, you have to think about that again. I mean, using something like artemisinin or methyljasminate or IV vitamin C, those aren't going to hurt you. Those are safe, innocuous things, and they may have powerful approaches to treat you. I wouldn't be aggressive enough to do something like insulin potentiated therapy in that setting or any kind of chemotherapy because you've got to have a clear diagnosis before you start giving aggressive treatments that have side effects that you have to worry about. In this particular study, okay, where they had these sniffer dogs looking at detecting lung cancer, the dogs found 71 out of 100 patients with lung cancer. Now, these are patients who had clinical lung cancer that was a problem, not people who just had a diagnosis of it that maybe it was going to be something and maybe not be something. And of the 400 controls that they had who didn't have cancer, they accurately identified 372. So your point here is a good one, Vicki. It's information that's part of a puzzle. And as usual, what we're trying to do is find ways to assess things, being a little bit innovative about it, and seeing if we can find some safer and less invasive ways of evaluating things. And sniffing dogs is another part of that little piece. We don't want to be doing colonoscopies and CT scans and mammograms and biopsies and endoscopies too much. Because we, let's face it, we do.
Well, they can be overdone, and they're invasive, and many times you can have complications from them.
No doubt. I mean, you just look at the colonoscopy. One in 200 people is going to have a perforation or a bleed that'll put you in the hospital. I mean, that's a lot. And actually, in the general population, about one in 200 is going to have something that you're going to find that you're going to save that person some trouble from, like a cancer or one that's a precancer. So the colonoscopy has got its ups and its downs. And if you're somebody who's fit, do a lot of exercise, and your vitamin D levels are good, you're probably looking at one in 400 or maybe even one in 500. So should we be doing routine colonoscopies across the board as one size fits all? Answer is no. Definitely not, in my opinion. We should select out who we do. If you have symptoms, by all means, it's the best way of getting an assessment of what's going on in the intestinal tract in the colon. So you have to understand and have experience with these things before you start making a lot of projections about what you think makes sense to you, particularly if you're younger and haven't been around longer. You know, after 4 years of practicing medicine, I've got a little something behind me.
And sometimes things don't make sense.
Yeah, they don't. And if you know they don't make sense, but it has a good outcome, well, I mean, don't be bullheaded about it. You know, you may want to do something that's against your principles. A lot of the time what it means is you don't know enough, and what you have to do is go back and learn things a little bit better and find out why it doesn't make sense to you, because there's always a reason why it doesn't make sense. So sniffer dogs, sure. Detecting lung cancer, breast cancer, sure. We should be doing more studies on it, absolutely. We should be perfecting this thing called spectrophotometry, no doubt about that. Because that may be the way that we can have the least invasive assessment of when a cancer means something and when it doesn't. And it's not like it's the most bizarre thing, because there's literature all over the place in the medical literature that talks about this approach to just analyzing the gases that we have in our exhaled breath. It's remarkable how complex our bodies are and how they show us things like what we're talking about. So I like the idea of being integrative. I also like the idea of being holistic, another huge word here that's different. And people frequently are mixing those two words up, because what we want to do is certainly look at as many different approaches as we can. That's for sure. But we also want to be looking at what the illness means in terms of the person's whole life story and how that fits into their particular family. So we need to know more about what caused this illness to develop. Is the body something that's reflective of our psycho-spiritual dis-ease, so that it's doing us a favor by making us sick, so we can take a look at something that's not in our best spiritual interest? All interesting things, and all started with this idea of sniffer dogs. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
Some opinions here for you to consider. especially the women out there. You know, if you're a woman, you may not even think about twice about the safety of your bra. And I want to give you something to think about, especially, you know, with all these advertisements with Victoria's Secret and some of the other fancy bras. It's really tempting to get some of these bras that actually might cause health problems. Now, a bra can be important for women that have large breasts that might have some discomfort otherwise. And certain bras, though, some of these popular styles, actually, you might be setting yourself up for some health problems, because you don't want an ill-fitting bra, because that could possibly spell trouble. Now, a lot of physicians and researchers agree that wearing a tight-fitting bra can cut off your lymph drainage.
Good point.
Which could possibly contribute to breast cancer.
It's possible.
Because your body's less able to excrete the toxins. Mm-hmm. Now, aluminum that you can get in antiperspirants, for example, is one potentially dangerous source of toxins that it can accumulate in your lymph drainage, and if your lymph drainage is impaired. So I think also it's a good thing to think about what's in your deodorant or in your antiperspirant, because aluminum certainly isn't a good ingredient. But over 85% of the lymph fluid that flows from the breast drains into the armpit lymph nodes, and most of the rest drains into the nodes along the breastbone. So bras and tight clothing can actually impede this flow. So the tightness and the length of the time that you wear the bra will influence the degree of the blockage of the lymphatic drainage, which just kind of makes sense. And so you don't want to cut that off and have chemicals that are toxic to be trapped in the breast.
And we know they are, too, Vicki. You got a good point there. You know, breast milk is more, it has more pollutants in it than just about anything else. In fact, if it had to be approved by the FDA because of the toxic things that are in it, it wouldn't be approved. There's that much toxic waste.
Even though it's still, we still think it's a better choice than cow's milk.
No question, advantages to it, but we screw it all up by poisoning it. And the breast gland is an excretory gland for a woman, and she puts her mercury and a lot of other heavy metals and all the toxins that are stored in fat into breast milk, and unfortunately gives it to the baby.
Also, constricting bras have been implicated in the rise of benign, which are non-cancerous, painful breast cysts and lumps. So it's just a good idea not to do that. And also, worse for your health might be the underwire bra. Everybody wants these push-up bras with these wires, but most of the underwire bras contain metal underwires that are coated with plastic, and the metal can actually cause the antenna effect. And that stimulates acupuncture and energy points below the breast, which could mess up the circuits that go to reflex points and could even, you know, cause problems in other organs and things in your body, like your liver and your gallbladder and your stomach and so forth.
Yeah, just because we don't know about it doesn't mean we should just throw it out.
And just because
we
it's not
study it.
And not just and because it might not be an immediate effect, so you might not even associate it with that. But it's just good to know about this.
Sure.
And also to realize that wire attracts electromagnetic fields, which might increase the risk of breast cancer.
And a lot of other things.
So I wanted to tell you about this study. It was over 4,000 women, and they found that women who don't wear bras have a much lower risk of breast cancer.
Is that right? Wow.
So women who wore their bras 24 hours a day had 3 out of 4 chance of developing breast cancer.
Wow.
So it's not good to wear it all day and sleep in it. And women who wore bras more than 12 hours a day, but see, that would be not to bed, had 1 out of 7 risk. Women who wore their bras less than 12 hours a day had a 1 out of 52 risk. And women who wore bras rarely or never had a 1 out of 168 chance of getting breast cancer. Remember the days when the women would throw their bras out the window and burn them and all that stuff?
Those were good old days, but now we're a little older. It doesn't mean so much to me anymore.
Yeah, but anyway, you know, the link between bras and breast cancer is about 3 times greater than the link between cigarette smoking and cancer.
Wow.
They also found that 90% of fibrocystic patients improve when they quit wearing their bras. Just remember that a healthy lifestyle depends on healthy choices, and the type of bra that you wear and the length of time that you wear it may make a difference. And I'd add that wearing cotton on the inside of the cup of your bra is a healthier thing instead of the plastic synthetic polyesters, and get rid of the underwires.
Well, it's amazing. You know, you hear about things like this, and you talk to most doctors about it, and they're going, oh, now you've gone around the bend. You're talking about things that we don't have that much data on, and they don't know the data that you just reported. And yet they still got an opinion.
Here's another opinion about the underwire if you're out there crying about it. You could maybe replace the wire with a plastic because that's not going to touch your skin. That's inside the bra fabric.
Maybe let's go back to the 60s. There's nothing wrong with braless.
But like I said at the top of the tip is that a lot of women that are older, I mean not older, a lot of women that have large breasts need that support because it might hurt their back or, you know, cause them some discomfort.
Right. Especially in this epidemic of obesity that we have. Great tip, Vicki. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
We all know that eating a high-fat meal can have problematic consequences. It can raise triglycerides, which are the fats inside the blood, and those can increase the risk of heart disease. But now researchers have found that here's a place where they want antioxidants as opposed to with chemo. But the researchers have found that 2 tablespoons of antioxidant spices reduce the negative effects of the high fat. And this would be things like cinnamon and turmeric and rosemary, oregano, black pepper, cloves, garlic, paprika.
All those good things we like.
Or maybe even just 5 ounces of red wine or 1.5 ounces of dark chocolate.
You can add that to it, too.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why we have different parts of our meal and different combinations of food. Maybe that's why Mother Nature put all that stuff out there for us, is to take it in its unadulterated state without processing or refining, without adding things to it that we don't need, and without taking out the good stuff so it stores better.
And I think that we're talking here about bad fats because there are good fats and there are bad fats. What's that book? There are fats that heal and fats that kill.
Udo Erasmus wrote a wonderful book with that title. I recommend it to everybody.
Well, we do want to stay away from trans fats.
For sure.
Partially hydrogenated fats. Even if you eat a lot of spices.
But keep in mind that this country has a fat phobia now. And it's not appropriate to have a fat phobia because fats are healthy. Fats are the foods that we burn normally. That's what we burn in our normal state, and we'll continue to burn them until we exercise to the point where we go into anaerobic metabolism, which burns carbohydrate. And that builds up lactic acidosis, and it's what makes us tired when we're doing hard exercise. So fat is a very good thing to consume. The problem is there are only 3 kinds of foods. There are sugars, fats, and there are proteins, and that's it. So if you cut back on one, you cut back on the carbs, you've got to eat something. So you're going to be left with what? Fat and with protein.
And, you know, some fat is good, too, because it also tides you over and you don't get hungry again so fast. A lot of people that are calorie counting and they're trying to lose weight, they're afraid of the fat because it's got a lot of calories. But sometimes you end up eating less because the fat holds you longer.
Fills you up better.
And then you don't get hungry and want to keep snacking.
Well, the foods that we eat should be eaten intelligently. I wouldn't say don't eat any carbohydrates. I would say don't eat any high fructose corn syrup. But I wouldn't say don't use sugar cane or natural sugars like that. It's okay in moderation. I wouldn't say don't eat any fats. I would say eat plenty of fats, but do it like Vicki's suggesting with the herbs that she's talking about. Add those to them because they're good for you.
And these 2 tablespoons of all these herbs, it sounds really good to me.
Well, some of them are anti-cancer. They're protect your nervous system. They protect your IQ. They protect people from getting Alzheimer's disease. I mean, there's a whole lot about herbs and spices that are really healthy.
And it sounds like so much, but, you know, none of the participants in the study had any GI effects or problems from it.
No. I mean, we put in 2 tablespoons of spices a lot of the time in the food that we eat. And I say the more the better because I love the spices.
You know, I was thinking about a lot of these TV ads that shows people eating a high-fat meal and then they advertise to pop sort of a stomach pill
for
acid indigestion.
That's nonsense.
But maybe just instead of doing that, just put all the herbs in there.
Well, instead of overeating, I mean, we could not overeat. That'd be the best thing to do. And you're going to have a fatty meal, you know, add the herbs and spices to it. I'd say in general, we need fruits and vegetables, seeds and nuts, and we need herbs and spices. That's the recipe for a healthy diet. And we should be doing that on a very regular basis. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888 874 4888, and we'll be back taking your calls after a short station break. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. If you have a question about your health, give us a call. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from Mike. Mike from Michigan. Are you there, Mike?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can we do for you?
I have a friend that has multiple system atrophy.
What's that?
It's something like new. It's similar to Parkinson's disease, but basically he's laying in bed and he can barely turn his neck. And it's just I was wondering if you to have heard of it or anything that we can do for him.
Is it because he's unable to turn it, or is it because it hurts?
It's because I think he's loaded with mercury and everything else, and we're trying to get everything out, but I don't know if you guys ever heard of anything like this.
Based on that, Mike, it would be hard, based on just what you've told me, to give you much of a suggestion, because I'm not sure what this person has. How old is he?
He's about
roughly
52, and he worked all his life in a sleep clinic in Henry Ford in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he was exposed to anything, but it's just, and he's losing all motions in his body and everything else.
Can he walk?
No.
Is it because he's weak or uncoordinated?
He can barely turn his neck.
He can't turn his neck, but can he move his legs?
Just very slightly, and once he sits up, he's got to go way down fast because his blood pressure just takes a dive.
Well, it sounds like he has a neurological condition, and that it's maybe autoimmune and attacking his nervous system, so that he's losing control of his autonomic nervous system, which maintains blood pressure.
Yes.
And he may well have something like multiple sclerosis or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Those are very tough diseases to treat.
Yes.
I like looking at the autoimmune nature of a lot of these illnesses, and I'm not trying to say that your friend has that, because based on what you told me, I wouldn't know. But
yes,
if that were the case, what I would try to do is shift his immune system from mainly making antibodies, and many of those antibodies may be attacking his own immune system, to making cells, they're called T cells, do the work of the immunity by attacking the viruses and the cancers and whatever else is there, and getting away from the autoimmune condition, because it's the antibodies that cause autoimmunity to occur. It's not the T cells. So sometimes by giving large doses of vitamin D, which is something maybe this person could talk to his or her doctor about, to see if that might be something to try. So certainly a vitamin D level should be measured, because there's such an epidemic of it, and somebody like this probably never gets out. And it causes a worsening of almost every illness we have.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's not giving you much, but then you haven't given me much either, Mike,
yeah,
so it's hard to work through that.
Yeah, it's something new, and they're calling it multiple system atrophy, and nobody knows, and there's supposed to be a specialist at Michigan, but mm-hmm. he doesn't give us any hope. I mean, they're just basically making them comfortable to die, and it's just sick. And
does he have
sick.
Pain? Does he hurt anywhere?
He has a lot of pain, yes.
Well, now, I could probably help him with that, but I'm in California near there, and it could be that maybe someone in Michigan there, at wherever he's going to be going, could use something called infrared light therapy or photonic stimulation.
Yes.
What I would encourage you to do is go to my website at drsaputo.com. That's D-O-C-T-O-R. Saputo, S-A-P-U-T-O.com,
yes,
and put in infrared light therapy in the search box, and up will come lots of articles about this technology I'm telling you about. We're doing research now at the University of California, San Francisco, on an NIH grant for $5 million on people who have neurological problems. And it could be that there would be an application for this if someone was sophisticated in the technology that might help him with the pain. It may not do anything for the illness, but it's really important to have quality of life.
Yes.
It doesn't sound like he has much, and that would be something to look into.
Well, you used it on multiple sclerosis.
I've used it on people who have neurological conditions. And it does help them with their pain and with their mobility most of the time. It's no sure thing, and there's not much data on it, but it doesn't have any downside to it that I've found in 12 years of use. So it'd be something I would suggest looking into. And if you want to drop me an email at Dr. Len, that's DRLEN, at drsabuto.com with more details about what's wrong with your friend, I'll get back to you, Mike.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Blessings.
Yeah, blessings. Have a good day. All right, the lines are open. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuto here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888.
There are many causes for depression and maltreatment of children, you know.
Abuse. Yeah,
mental,
child abuse.
Physical, sexual abuse in children can cause biological changes that actually make them twice as likely to develop multiple and long-lasting depressive episodes, and they're less likely to respond to traditional pharmaceuticals and psychological treatment for depression.
Well, that's right. There is so much PTSD out there, post-traumatic stress syndrome, that it blows me away. You know, the service says there's something like 18% of people that come out of the service have PTSD, and that is so much BS, it's hard to believe. When you're in a battleground and you're seeing people around you having horrible things happen to them, it leaves a dent in your mind. I'm sorry. It just does. So just about everybody who's been in that setting starts to ask themselves, what am I doing here? What's going on? How can we get into a war? Look what's just happened to my friend. I mean, I've watched somebody die. This is terrible. Almost everybody has PTSD. And when you look at kids, when they're abused physically, emotionally, or sexually, same thing happens. And these kids don't have the tools to deal with what happened with them because they're kids.
Parents need to stop and think what they're doing to their kids.
Well, they do, but see, they've got their problems too.
And they can't help it?
No, they can't help it. And it doesn't make it okay.
Well, they better find some other coping mechanism.
Well, they better, or else the consequence is going to be what we're talking about. And that's what you're going to see, all this PTSD coming out. And being a problem. But it's time for another 2020 tip, Vicki. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuto here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back talking more about kids' abuse that's linked to long-term depression and poor response to drug treatment.
Interesting, we were talking to Mike out of Michigan because I have a story, because I think laughter is the best medicine, that happened to somebody, to the Phillips, that lived in Walled Lake, Michigan.
Okay.
And George.
Maybe one of his neighbors.
Yeah, well, George Phillips, he's this elderly man, and he was going to bed when his wife told him that he'd left the light on in the garden shed, which she could see from the bedroom window, and so he opened the back door to go turn off the light, but he saw that there were these people in the shed stealing things.
Oh, geez.
So he phones the police, and they said, well, is somebody in your house? And he said, no, but somebody's breaking into my garden shed, and they're stealing from us. And the police dispatcher said, well, all patrols are busy, and you should just lock your doors, and an officer will be along when one's available.
Jeez.
So George says, okay. Hangs up the phone, counts to 30, then he phones the police again. Hello, I just called you a few seconds ago because there were people stealing things from my shed. Well, you don't have to worry about them now because I just shot and killed them both. The dogs are eating them right now, and he hung up.
Oh, that's great.
Well, within 5 minutes.
Yeah, there you go.
5 minutes, 6 police cars, a SWAT team, helicopter, 2 fire trucks, a paramedic, an ambulance showed up at the Phillips residence and caught the burglars red-handed. And one of the policemen said to George, I thought you said you'd shot them. And George said, I thought you said there was nobody available.
That's great.
The moral of that is don't mess with old people. They're pretty wise.
That's correct. And don't forget it. All right. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuto here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, so we were talking about abuse in children, mm-hmm. and how it's linked to this long-term depression and poor response to treatment. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder about some of the symptoms that people children are being diagnosed with for ADD and ADHD, because it seems like we have an epidemic of that. And I'm wondering, Is this really what it is, or it's because maybe sometimes there's dysfunction at home and they're having trouble concentrating and trouble focusing because their mind is on other things?
Exactly.
And why is there such an epidemic of eating disorders and cutting? We never used to hear of that so much. And I mean, I guess abuse has been going on for a lot of years.
Well, you couldn't be more right, Vicki. I mean, when 10 to 25% of kids have been abused, that means that they are carrying around a lot of things that have happened to them that they cannot resolve because they didn't have the tools to do it. And the problem is that there are a lot of triggers that develop from that that remind them unconsciously of what happened when they were abused that can take them from a very calm setting and put them into a real funk. And sometimes they do things like get hyperactive or they get depressed or they get anxious or they do the things that they do as some of the bipolar kids do. These are common things, and the answer isn't drug them up, which is what the medical profession and Big Pharma would have you believe. The best treatment is not about drugs. I mean, has a drug ever solved an emotional, physical, or sexual abuse?
Well, it might numb somebody for a bit.
Well, but has it ever dealt with the underlying problem?
Oh, and that's what we need to do. But then some people complain that they go to the psychologist or the psychiatrist and they just talk for years and it doesn't take care of it either.
Okay, so you could lose both ways. You could lose by using the drugs and overdo things. And a lot of people are on as many as 10 psychological drugs at the same time.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they're, quotes, resistant to therapy. And they're on antipsychotics for things like this as well, which is, to me, insane to even think about. So drugs are not the answer. And the psychotherapy may not be either. You may know every little detail about what happened to you when you were younger and these things happened because of abuse. And so what? You have to learn how to deal with the problem, too. And that's why you have to try another approach. How many people go to the shrink for 10, 15 years and haven't solved their problem? Of those people, I think we should be looking at things like somatic psychotherapy. And what I mean by that is looking at the body as a reservoir of all these memories that are tied up in muscle tension patterns in our body.
The problem is with Western medicine, I don't think the psychiatrists are supposed to touch you.
Well, isn't that the most interesting thing? It's the only way that you're going to elicit these responses that are held in the musculoskeletal system. You have to do gentle kinds of massage to loosen up those areas that are holding this information. And when it comes back into conscious awareness, maybe 10, 20, or 50, even 50 years later, you would like to think that the problems that you had as a child when you didn't have the tools, that you now have the tools all these years later, and when the issue comes back and it's alive and fresh in your mind and you're feeling it, you know what to do. And under the supervision of somebody who understands psychology and understands how this physical massage therapy works, you can really get into dealing with these problems very slowly.
But the way our system is, too, is that when you go to a psychiatrist, basically you're only there for about 15 minutes because they give you a medication.
Well, that's right.
And then they send you, where do they send you?
To the psychologist. Yeah, I mean, they ought to be embarrassed. They're the victims of Big Pharma and all of its BS at trying to get people to be stuck on these drugs, many of which are no better than placebo.
And the health insurance companies, too, because I guess it's cheaper that way.
Well, I don't know if it's cheaper or not. Well, I think it is, but, you know, it's just outrageous to me that it's like that. You know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, when I started thinking this way, everybody thought I was crazy. They were all saying, yeah, Dr. Len went around the bend. He used to be pretty good. I mean, he was our ICU, CCU doc. He had a big practice. And all of a sudden now he's talking about wellness and nutrition and natural therapies and psycho-spiritual essence and the somatic psychotherapy. Well, it's been 20, 25 years later. And guess what? This stuff's now in some of the mainstream, and we're starting to realize how important it is. I have to admit, it took me 20 years after medical school to figure it out, and I'm not proud of that. But I knew something was wrong all along.
At least you figured it out.
Well, at least I figured it out, and now I feel like we're leading the way in lots of ways by talking about these kinds of issues. We have to look at more than just giving drugs and technologies herbs and supplements and things that will change how illness will behave, because they aren't what caused it. You may need to use something like that from time to time to control symptoms, because symptoms can be very unpleasant, but they never deal with the underlying problem. You've got to find out what the meaning of the illness is in terms of that person's whole life story, what their exposures have been like, and what is going on in their whole community. Because if you don't do that, you're only looking at an isolated symptom in an isolated way. It's like putting your fingers in a dike and trying to keep the dike from breaking. That's treating the symptoms. It's not treating all the underlying problems. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Now I want you to go back in time. And remember before you we had these Ask Your Doctor ads on TV about prescription drugs? You never would ask your doctor about, you know, should I take this drug or that drug or whatever. And then in the late 1990s, when these direct-to-consumer drug ads came on TV, it sold diseases also to go with the drugs, like it sold seasonal allergies and GERD and depression, and it sold risk diseases like heart events for which you'd take statin drugs like Lipitor, and osteoporosis, which you'd take a bone drug like Boniva, and asthma attacks for which you'd use an asthma drug like Advair. And, of course, just by the very definition of prevention, you didn't know if the drugs were working, but you weren't paying out of pocket anyways, so you didn't even care.
Listen, this whole thing has become a huge advertising scheme for the most part. Drugs are way overused, so are technologies. We hardly ever look for the underlying reason for why people are sick. I'm still stuck on that same track. And you look at direct-to-consumer ads, that was a brilliant idea, because that was a way of getting information to people, scaring the hell out of them, so they think, oh, I need this drug no matter what it is. And that, of course, is never going to be solving a problem. It may be solving a symptom, but not a problem.
Personally, how does it affect you when a patient comes to you and asks you if they can take a drug? Does it make you, does it pressure you to want to give it to them?
No, it makes me sad to think that they've been hoodwinked into thinking they need a drug to solve their problem.
Can you talk them out of it?
Well, I tell them the truth. I say, this is what you're doing when you talk about using a drug. And if you want to do that, I can prescribe it. I'd rather not, because I'd like to think that you'd like to go deeper into what your health issue is so we can do something about it, rather than, you know, try to mask the symptom and have you think that everything's okay, because it's not. You've worked out nothing. The fact is that when I give you a drug like this, I'm doing you a disservice, because I'm taking away the psycho-spiritual reason for why you got whatever symptom you got in the first place. I believe that all the illnesses that we have are dished out for a reason. And, you know, a lot of people take exception to that, but I've been doing this business for a long time, and I've come to that conclusion, and it's not like I can always solve the problem, because I can't. But when I do, it's wonderful how we can look and see at what we can do to help people by not just masking the symptoms and getting down there and solving the problem. And it's why we do healing circles, where we bring all these practitioners together, maybe five or six or seven people together with a patient who's not getting better, and we spend 2 hours. We don't charge them 1 cent, and we just be with them after they've written an autobiography of their physical, emotional, and spiritual health from birth to now, and sit with them. And the wonderful things that happen in a setting like that make real breakthroughs oftentimes, so that people get the idea of what's happening in their life that led to it having to come out this way.
Well, the reason you don't charge for it is because you want the patient to really feel that you care.
Indeed, that's true. Plus, they're already my patient, and I'll donate a little bit more time to that. Even if they're not my patient, I'll donate time to that. At least once a week for a couple of hours, that's not asking too much to give back. Especially when we're doing all these things to people. We're inventing all these diseases you were talking about, like osteopenia, ain't no disease, I'm sorry, or pre-hypertension, ain't no disease, or pre-anything, pre-obesity.
And getting people to take seizure drugs like Lyrica for headaches and antipsychotics for mood problems and all that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But then what about all these risk disclosures that you hear about? The brain bleeds, the sudden death, the difficulty breathing,
we
the stomach bleeding, the liver failure, kidney
ears.
Failure, muscle breakdown, fainting, hallucinations.
Yeah, what you're listening to.
And do you know that when they do that, they even sell more drugs?
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
It's crazy.
Well, see, people want to think there's a solution that they can have that's for them. And they don't want to look at all the things that can happen to them if it doesn't work right. And so they stay convinced that this is what they should do. So when it comes to time to look at all the side effects, they're still thinking about, gee, this may help my overactive bladder, or this may help my erectile dysfunction, or it may help prevent me from having a cholesterol that's going up. That's what they're looking at.
But I still think that if people had to pay out of pocket, they probably wouldn't be taking
that. Yeah, maybe that's some
strokes.
Of it. But, you know, it's not by legislation. It's not by punishment. It's by inspiration that we're going to create change. And that's what we need to focus on with things like this.
And then
this.
Like what you were just talking about a little while ago, was about these psychiatric drug cocktails. You know, sometimes people are taking 8, 10, 12 drugs for
that's
the treatment for this resistant
incredible.
Depression.
That's
and
just
the post-traumatic
incredible.
Stress disorder, even though the drugs have never been tested when taken together, they're still doing
I'll
this.
I have to tell you, Vicki, I had a patient in the hospital about 4 months ago, and it wasn't in my hospital. It was someplace else, because they were getting a treatment for cancer that was not in my area. And I still checked in with the patient from time to time. And they finally said, we can't manage this person anymore. They're uncontrollable. They're getting a little crazy. And I said, well, let's have a look and see what you're giving this person in terms of medicines. This person was on about 15 drugs, and my first comment, many of which were psychoactive drugs. I said, stop all the medicines. And they said, what?
So try them yourself and see how
medicine.
You feel.
Right. You take these drugs one night, see how you are the next day. And they got the point, and they did that. Within 3 days, the person woke up and was fine. And you see this all the time, particularly in our convalescent hospitals. We've got our elderly patients who have been put out to pasture, basically abused because nobody's there to listen and care about who they are. They're put on drugs for everything. And it's unusual for somebody not to have 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 drugs. That's malpractice. But look at the wonderful advertising success of Big Pharma. They're selling more drugs than ever.
Well, like, look at all these ADD drugs. I mean, no wonder people are having trouble sleeping at night.
Exactly.
But then they can sell sleeping aids.
Oh, it's just a vicious cycle, Vicki. You're right. And unfortunately, there's a revolving door between a lot of government agencies and the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, look at the case of Julie Gebberding. She was what? The head of the CDC. And she was making all these outrageous statements a couple of years ago about vaccines, which I've written a lot about. And where did she turn up after her job at CDC is over? She's the head of Merck Vaccines. See any connection there? Thank you, Dr. Gebberding, for your high quality of integrity.
Well, the other thing they do to try to kind of endear people to all this stuff is and humanize these diseases, you know, they give them nicknames like RA, you know,
rheumatoid arthritis,
Hep C. And,
well, we should call it CDC, like Communicable Disease Center, and FDA for, okay, then all those things. You're right. It seems to have an endearing quality to it. And then we just assume that that's the way we do things. And what we have is a lot of sleeping people who aren't coming to the rescue of themselves or the rest of us. And so what we have a system that is so dysfunctional and so bizarre that we've accepted that it's okay for close to 1 million people to die every year from problems that develop in the treatment of people using Western medicine. And I don't mean just drugs. The whole thing, about 1 million people a year. I mean, we're outraged by a few thousand in Iraq. I mean, get those terrorists. What about the terrorists over here?
Yeah.
What about the 400,000 people dying from pharmaceutical drugs? How about the overuse of medications and doing too many surgeries and looking at the economics of what's happening here? Everybody's interested in the economics of medicine, but they're not interested in real medicine, in good medicine, in medicine that actually delivers care, where you do two things. You listen and you care. Where the hell did that go? That's distressing. We need to come back to the basics and start looking at what we're doing in this country and in our local communities. We've given up. We've become savages, basically, that are narcissistic pigs. We're taking care of ourselves, and we don't give a damn about the person next door. What's my 401k, or what's my stock portfolio, or how much real estate do I own? It's about money and things.
Well,
it's not about what can
money,
I do to help
well,
you.
Speaking of money, too, Big Pharma is also so – what do you say, subsidizing patient groups that lobby the FDA also?
Oh, listen, it's business, Vicki. It's just about business. It's about return on investment. It has nothing to do with human evolution. It has nothing to do with making the world a better place or helping somebody just because you want to help because you think that's a good thing. It is more about what can I get for me and what's my return on investment and how my stockholder is going to be. And if I don't do that job as the CEO of this country, of this company, I'll be thrown out and somebody else will be put in who will do that. What are you going to do about that? The answer is evolve. Evolve. Don't revolve. We're in the business of revolving and revolution. We can't live that way. Because if we do, this is what we get. And then you have to listen to people like me and Vicky outraged. But outrage isn't even making a change. Because you have to actually evolve yourself. Be the change you want to see. Be that example that makes a change. If you will do that, somehow, this country, this community will become a country that it was at one time when we supported one another and we cared about people and we listened to their problems and we were there if they needed, we needed trouble.
If we needed trouble?
If we needed trouble. If we needed help with our troubles. That's right. All right. I'd like to remind you that we're back to talk live and talk about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and on DrSaputo.com. And from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Standard Time. And all these shows are also archived on drsaputo.com.
Remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a wonderful week. See you next Monday.